get the podcast going. All right, so now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of the problem of class formation, trying to work at some of these foundational concepts that help us build a way of talking systematically about these issues. And as I said last time, the framework which I'm going to adopt as the framework on which you then elaborate empirical details when you study things has as its point of departure the language of game theory. And that's what we'll explore today, how we can think about solidarity and class struggle more systematically within that broad kind of framework. So let's begin by just, first of all, briefly talking about what we mean by solidarity. Solidarity is, you know, a grand term on the left, in social movements, in working class struggles. One of the great songs of the American labor movement is Solidarity Forever. Got sung around the Capitol building 2 years ago with great fervor. What do we mean by solidarity? What, as a sociological concept? So here's how I defined it. I presented it in the outline. Solidarity, class solidarity, refers to the willingness of individual members of a class to support the collective struggles of the class by bearing various kinds of individual costs or sacrifices. Solidarity is the willingness to bear costs for collective struggle. I think that's the kind of bottom line way of thinking about it. Now, there are a variety of different, more fine-grained mechanisms that would explain why you're willing to bear costs. Two different mechanisms, closely connected but distinct, I think are important to think about. One is, uses the model of a family. You're willing to bear costs for the well-being of your children because you care about your children, about your spouse, about your siblings, about your extended family. So your actual, your own well-being depends upon the well-being of others. I mean, any parent knows that it's impossible to be a happy parent with an unhappy child. I mean, the happiness of a parent depends upon the happiness of a child. That doesn't mean that you only care about your happiness and that's why you care about the child. No, but it means that your sense of what it means to live well in the world fully incorporates the well-being of another person. So that's one reason why you're prepared to make sacrifices in the collective struggles, is because you actually don't just care about yourself, you care about other people. That's a little different from saying you feel an obligation to make sacrifice, that there's a moral imperative to make the sacrifice. It's not quite that there's a duty to do so. It's not, you can have a, feel a duty to make a sacrifice even if you don't particularly care about the other people, but you feel it's your responsibility to do so. That second reason is the one that's most intimately connected to the collective action problem in a way. Both are connected, but for those of you who have delved in moral philosophy, there's a certain way of talking about this, the Kantian imperative, that you have an obligation to behave the way you want other people to behave. Right? So if you feel it's in your interests that other people participate in a strike, then you have an obligation to do so as well. You have a duty to do things that you want other people to do. So if we have a collective action situation, which we'll explore in a moment, in which the ideal, you'll actually benefit if everybody else cooperates, you may not care about their benefit, but if you're going to benefit from their cooperation, you have an obligation to cooperate as well. Another way of putting it is that there's a, from a Kantian moral universe perspective, it's immoral to be a free rider. You have a duty to not be a free rider, and that's why you cooperate. Now, that's different. You see why that's a different mechanism than the simple interdependency of your well-being with other people? Now, these two often go together. So parents feel duty, obligation, responsibility, but they also feel love. And love and duty aren't the same. I mean, the simple words that you can use to identify these two mechanisms are love and duty. I think robust solidarity involves both. People feel personally connected to other people so that they feel grief and sadness when other people are doing badly. But they also feel feel guilt if they don't participate. So if the mechanism, I mean, this is another way of thinking about it. If you fail to participate, do you feel guilty? You haven't done your bit. Well, that's the Kantian process. That's the duty process kicking in. If you fail to participate because you can't for some reason, do you just feel sad? You feel regret, but not guilt, because you care about the people. That's the love mechanism. Solidarity, in its most robust forms, combines these two. You can think of it as the emotional tie and the moral obligation going together. But the behavioral fact of the behavior that's being identified by solidarity is the willingness to bear various kinds of individual costs through support of collective struggles. The support can be active, you know, joining in a protest or a strike, or it can be passive. Not crossing a picket line is a form of solidarity. Not crossing a picket line does not display solidarity if there's no benefit for you to cross the picket line. You know, if it's the expression "don't cross a picket line" implies you don't cross it because in the absence of the picket line you would. And therefore, you're giving up something. It may be small, but you're still giving up something. This importance of solidarity reflects, I think, a fundamental fact about class struggle between dominant classes, or between subordinate classes and dominant classes, between the exploited and the exploiter, between the subordinate and the dominant, which is the central resource that working class organizations engaged in struggle have. The basic thing that they can deploy in struggle is people. Klaus Offe has a nice way of saying this, that the power of capitalists depends upon their willingness to pay, and the power of workers depends upon their willingness to act. The classic expressions, the power of the people, means not just, means it literally. It's the power of the people is people, which is a shorthand for action, energy, effort, time. That's what ordinary people have available as a resource to deploy in conflict, is their time and effort, and of course in the extreme cases their lives, when you have struggles that escalate to that point. And the willingness to act is what's in play in invoking solidarity as a key component of class conflict. What we want to then do in this lecture is really understand the mechanisms by which solidarity works and the conditions which increase and decrease it. Okay? And that's where I think this free rider problem turns out to be an extremely useful device as a way of giving precision to the problem. So let's look at the free rider problem again. I've presented here in the outline the classic format for laying this out, this little kind of game theory table. Here is the issue in a free rider problem. You have some kind of collective action which, if successful, will benefit you. So the premise is that you will indeed benefit if the collective action is successful. If it's a strike, if the strike succeeds, you'll get a pay raise. And we're in a situation where it turns out that you'll get the benefit whether or not you yourself participate. So there are collective action situations where that's not true. The only way you get the benefit is by participating. So you can think of playing a sport as a collective action. It's a bunch of people getting together to cooperate to play soccer. Well, you don't get the benefit of playing soccer if you don't play soccer. So that's a case where the benefit is entirely based on the in-process benefits of the collective action. It's fun. Well, there's no collective action problem when the actual process of participation in the cooperation is itself what generates the benefit. Collective action problems occur when the success of the collective action problem yields benefits for everyone, whether or not they participate. That situation, another way of describing it, is that the benefits of the collective action are a public good. Public goods are goods which everyone benefits from, whether or not they pay for it. And in the case of collective action, paying for it means participating in the collective action. Okay, so we have a situation where you have an interest in the success of the collective action, but you have to decide, am I going to participate or not? And everybody else makes the same decision. So the simple format for laying out this logic is to have a table where you control what you do. You don't control what everybody else does. So you have absolute control over your own participation. You can stay home or show up. Showing up is called cooperating with the collective action. Staying home is called defecting from the collective action. And everyone else has the same option. And in the simple format, you just do this dichotomy between you and everybody else. Of course, it can be almost everybody, most people, some people. You know, you can make all sorts of additional wrinkles to this. Let's keep it simple. Most of the action comes from the simple form, fortunately, in this. So you have four options, four combinations, A, B, C, D, usually laid out in this way. Universal cooperation is A. Universal defection, nobody shows up, is D. Everybody else showing up and you sitting on the sidelines is B. That's the free rider. You showing up and nobody else does is C. That's sometimes called the martyr. You know, it's the person who shows up for the revolution, guns in hand, and nobody else is there. There are three quantities that are important that get generated by this set of options. A minus D is the gain from cooperation. That's what the benefit to everyone is if everybody cooperates instead of everybody defecting. Call that the gain from cooperation. B minus A is the gain from free riding. That's how much you gain by not participating, as long as everybody else does. The way to think about this is B is the cost to you. It costs you something to participate. And A is what you would get if the cooperation succeeds. And B minus A, therefore, is the difference between those two. And D minus C is the loss from unilateralism, or the sucker penalty. That's what happens if you show up for the strike and get fired as a result. The strike doesn't succeed, and you lose your job, and you're a sucker because everybody else didn't bear that cost. Way of thinking about it, this is a collective action problem. It turns out this is exactly the same problem as the prisoner's dilemma. That's why the prisoner's dilemma story is used as the parable for collective action problems. The rank order of preferences, if you are selfish, you only care about your own interests and you have no sense of moral obligation, so neither the Kantian mechanism nor the comradeship mechanism, the love mechanism, neither of those mechanisms are in play in your preferences. So you're purely selfish and you're rational. You're making the best choice possible. Your preference orderings are B, A, D, C. You prefer what you, if you could snap your fingers and have the world turn out that way, you'd prefer to have everybody else cooperate and you sit on the sidelines. Your second choice would be for everybody to cooperate, including you. Your third choice would be for everybody to defect, and the worst thing, the thing you want least, is for you to be the only person that cooperates. BADC is your preference ordering. And of course, the tragedy of the commons, that's another context for this, by the way, is what's called the tragedy of the commons. It's the same basic problem. Is that if everybody has the same preference ordering as you do, if everybody has BADC as their preference ordering, then everybody defects and you end up with D, even though everybody prefers A over D. Now, this is also one of the great counterintuitive discoveries of social science of the last half century or so. You know, it really is counterintuitive. When I teach this to my in my big freshman course, no matter how many times I explain it, there will be 25% of the students who just don't believe it. They think I've made something wrong, and they keep trying to show that it can't be the case if everybody's acting rationally in their self-interests that they end up with something that's suboptimal. Because the idea that in the interconnections of people's strategies is what determines the outcome, not just your own choices. It's actually a pretty hard thing to get intuitively, you know, in your bones. At least for some people. Now, if the world really was like this, so this is a model. Remember, this is a model. It says if people are entirely selfish, they only care about themselves, and they have no Kantian moral commitments, no duty and no love. And if they are rational, they are not deluded, they actually understand what the choices are, then this is their preference ordering, and the result will be no collective action. But we observe collective action all the time in the world. It happens a lot. It doesn't happen all the time, but it's not rare. And that shows us that this isn't an accurate model for what's actually going on in the world. But it does help us figure out what is going on in the world. We have to then ask, what is it about the world that deviates from this model? And that's a way of giving precision to what's generating the solidarity, what's generating the actual willingness of people to cooperate when they would be better off if they didn't. What's going on here? I think it's important to quickly dispense with a false solution, which is surprisingly common because it's, once you think about it, it's so obviously not an answer to the question, why do we get collective action given this set of dilemmas? A false solution is to invoke the collective benefits to the group that comes from the struggle as the explanation for why the struggle occurs. To give an explanation of the following form, working class struggle occurs and takes the form it does because it is in the collective interests of the working class as such. It's in the collective interests of this entity, the working class, and the working class decides to engage in struggle because it's in the collective interests. That's a non-answer to the question, why does collective action occur? It's a false solution. It's unsatisfactory above all because it begs the question. It just assumes what needs to be proven in the answer itself. Since, in fact, individuals have brains and minds and agency and make the choice about whether to participate, collectivities don't have minds that make choices. So the collectivity of the working class doesn't have a meta-mind that makes the choice to collectively participate. The individual human beings that are part of that collectivity are the entities that are making the choices. And therefore, you can't invoke the collective choice, the collective interests, by a collective chooser to explain why there's collective struggle. By the way, this is a side point which I know this is probably pointless to make in the linguistic universe we happen to live in, and it refers to the expression begs the question. So begs the question has come to be used in to mean simply asks the question. That's become a use of that expression, begs the question. It has a more precise logical use, a use as a form of argument, which is, I think, a precious use for which there is no alternative expression, and which has gotten crushed by this misuse of the term. When you say to someone, you've begged the question, what that means is you've assumed the answer to the question in the way you ask the question, or in the way you've answered it. It's a non-answer to a question is begging the question. It's a non-answer to the question. That reflects a logical fallacy. It's like saying, why is this person unattractive? It's because they're ugly. Right? So to say a person is unattractive because they're ugly is just saying they're unattractive because they're unattractive. And that's begging the question. So when you see, even in the New York Times occasionally, you'll see somebody saying, and this begs the question, why did he do this? Which just their meaning begs in the sense of, I beg you to ask the question. But begging the question is a logical fallacy. And that we don't have any other catchphrase in English to express that logical fallacy. And so I have this vain hope that it'll get restored. I think the way language develops is that once a meaning gets lost by having another meaning added that's much simpler, it's probably hopeless. But I do nevertheless, whenever students use begs the, and maybe some of you have in the in your papers, I never punish anybody for this, but I do correct it. I feel impelled to uphold the classic use. All right, collective explanations of collective behavior are never satisfactory. They're never satisfactory. They can be useful shorthands in some contexts, so I'm not making a completely dogmatic claim, that there's never a sentence that should have the form, the working class decided that, or the ruling class insists that. The ruling class is supporting American foreign policy. Well, that's a useful shorthand in some contexts. But the ruling class is not an entity that chooses things. People in the ruling class form collective organizations, typically by paying for them, because willingness to pay is what gives them their collective capacities. And they delegate certain kinds of decision to those collective organizations because they buy it, essentially. And then those collective organizations, as organizations, we can say the organization has decided, which is also a shorthand for the leadership and organizing, executive committee having reached a decision. Those are all useful shorthands, but they're never adequate accounts of the mechanisms involved, because persons make decisions. This is essentially what it means to insist on micro foundations for any argument, is to not make the mistake of thinking that collective entities make collective choices. It doesn't mean that there aren't macro phenomena that constrain the choices of individuals. That's certainly true. Being a individual worker in an environment of intensely competitive capitalism, which is a description of the macro environment, surely affects the choices of persons. So macro settings have massive effects on the choices of persons. But whenever you're invoking a choice, it's a choice of persons. Systems don't make choices. Systems have dynamics. Systems develop in particular ways. But the actual choice-making process, the agency moments in the process, come from human persons acting as sole practitioners or in collaboration with others. So this is why this is a subtle and slippery issue. The relational aspect of choice making, your embeddedness in networks and structures of relations, is absolutely fundamental. We don't make choices as atomized separate entities that are just disconnected and floating around. The choices are made by virtue of our connectivity. But it's still the case that it's not the connectivity that's doing the choosing, it's the persons. And that's why statements of the form working class struggles occur and takes the form it does because of the collective interests of the working class is not an explanation. It's a substitute for an explanation. Okay, so what are the solutions? I mean, we know that collective action occurs. How can it occur if given these preference orderings? Well, there's a bunch of ways that we can say, yes, this model shows us ways in which the model is incorrect. It's not an accurate model for why certain things happen. Jan Elster, I think, has a very nice description of how to proceed in exploring why collective action actually occurs. And he suggests that there's a sequence that should be followed. We should begin with this very simplest story, the free rider problem. Then we should ask, well, can we figure out ways in which collective action can occur even if people are selfish and rational? So what would we have to change about the prisoner's dilemma without changing either the rationality or the selfishness assumption? Secondly, maybe what we have to do is change the selfishness assumption. Maybe people have preferences other than selfish preferences. And the third possibility is maybe people are acting irrationally. That sequence, saying we begin with selfish rationality, we then modify the selfishness, and then we modify the rationality. We add these complexities in that sequence. That's not because of a belief that selfish rationality is the most general explanation. It's that it's the simplest explanation. It may be, in fact, that most collective action occurs, for example, here would be an example. Most collective action occurs because people are vulnerable to wishful thinking. Wishful thinking is a form of magical thinking, which is irrational. It's a way in which you deceive yourself about the importance of your own actions. So people might engage in collective actions because they falsely believe that they have the magical, they wouldn't say it this way, but the magical power to make all the difference. You go to the protest somehow under the illusion that your participation is going to change the outcome of the protest. And it's an illusion, because in most protests, whether or not you go isn't going to have any effect whatsoever on the outcome. But people believe it does. Well, I don't believe that's the reason why people participate, but if it were, it would say that irrationality is a really important part of participation. Well, Elster is not prejudging the relative importance of these things, but he's saying this is the sequence by which you should build up your explanations. Okay, let's look at each of these, see how it works. Collective action with rational, selfish actors. What we see in the prisoner's dilemma setup, the collective action setup here, if you got rational and selfish actors, you're not going to get collective action. So how can you have collective action if indeed everybody is rational, completely clear-headed, perfect information, no delusions, and they're absolutely egotistical, self-centered, self-interested actors. They don't care about anybody but themselves. How can you get collective action? Well, the assumption that you have to modify, and it's a really interesting process when you modify it, is the following. The way I've described the story here, it's a one-shot game. That is, you make one decision. Do I cooperate or do I not? So that's what a one-shot game is. You only have to make one decision. Let's modify this in the following way. Let's suppose that you play this game every day. Day after day after day. Every day you have to make the decision. Should I cooperate or not? It's not just a one-shot game. It's a perpetual game. When it's a perpetual game, it's called an iterated prisoner's dilemma. The word iterated is used in this context to describe a game that just goes on and on and on, and you have to constantly make the decision, should I participate, should I not? You have a guerrilla revolutionary movement, and every day the recruiter comes to your door, so to speak, and says, are you going to join or are you going to stay home? You know, it's not, that's an exaggeration, but, you know, it's a perpetual decision. Not just a one-shot decision. Well, then things suddenly become quite a bit more complicated. It's no longer clear that the best strategy is to universally defect. And it's particularly, what you now have to do is you have to decide what's going to be my strategy over time. So one possibility is you could cooperate for 5 rounds of the game and then defect. Or you could have a subtle strategy which says, I will cooperate the first time, the first round, and if other people cooperate, then I'll cooperate the second round. And if other people cooperate, then I'll cooperate in the third round. But if they defect, then I'm going to defect in the next round. You could design a strategy which says what I do depends upon what other people did, right? Now, we all know there's a name for that strategy, tit for tat, right? So tit for tat is a description of a way of dealing with a potential sort of conflict situation, which is I'll behave well if you behave well. If you behave badly, then I'll behave badly. You know, so if I'll begin by behaving well and observe your behavior. If you behave badly, then I'm going to behave badly. That's tit for tat. There's a fantastically cool book. It's in one of these, you know, fairly easy to read books that had a huge impact and which is filled with really interesting stories. Yeah.
So is the cost for, like, let's say, so it's on a time scale, and that first day that you decide to cooperate, is the cost for cooperating and then finding out that no one else is cooperating, is that cost lower than it would be if it was just a one-shot deal?
It's not that the cost on that first day is lower.
Yeah.
It's that you have to then compare the costs of that happening to the costs of never participating. Because it's going to go on into the future,
okay.
Right? And since you know other people are going to have strategies also that respond to what you do, mm-hmm. It's no longer so simple. In this first case, other people can't retaliate. Mm-hmm. You know, so tit for tat is a kind of punishment strategy. I'm going to cooperate with you, but then I'm going to punish you if you don't, because mm-hmm. I'm going to then not cooperate in the next round. So here, this book, The Evolution of Cooperation by Robert Axelrod, I do recommend that you read it. At some time. It's an enjoyable, very engaging book. He did the following experiment. He contacted 100 famous game theorists. These were all very sophisticated mathematical game theorists. And he proposed to them what's called a computer tournament, in which every person submits a strategy, how they would play an iterated prisoner's dilemma. So it's going to go over and over and over again. 100 rounds, or I don't remember what the specification was. And they had to submit a strategy. So a strategy could be, I'm going to defect the whole time. Another strategy could be, I'm going to just unilaterally cooperate the whole time. Or I will cooperate, but if the other person defects, then I will defect from then on. Or tit for tat, that's the simple one. So he had 100 people, including Anatole Rapoport, who was the most famous sort of founder of this. Anatole Rapoport submitted the strategy tit for tat, the simplest strategy. He was the only person out of the 100 that submitted tit for tat. And then the question is, you play every strategy against every other strategy and see which strategy does best overall. Now, tit for tat does not do better than some other strategies when it's just paired with them, right? But those strategies do terribly against more of the remaining strategies. What happens is tit for tat won. Tit for tat was the strategy that won out. You had a higher overall payout playing against the 99 other strategies if you adopted tit for tat. What Axelrod then did is give these results to these 100 theorists. They saw the results. They saw how tit for tat did against all the others, and asked them to redesign their strategies in light of these results. And once again, Anatole Rapoport submitted tit for tat, and everybody else did really elaborate strategies. You know, two tats for one tit, two tit, tit, tat, tat, all sorts of complicated strategies in light of the results of the first tournament. But of course, they were all making theirs more sophisticated, but they had to contend with all these other more sophisticated strategies. And tit for tat won the second round as well. Mm-hmm. Now, Axelrod makes the argument that there's an evolutionary, we have then reason to believe why tit for tat is a universal human repertoire. That is, every culture has some version of tit for tat. In every culture, there's some notion of having a disposition to cooperate with people for common good, and if they violate the cooperation, you retaliate. But it's tit for tat, it's proportional. The idea of tit for tat is you retaliate, but not disproportionately, so that cooperation can resume. That's why the book is called The Evolution of Cooperation. Yeah.
Or how does that relate to ideology or like class
consciousness? Okay. So the notion of rationality here is individual. It's individuals making a rational choice given the information they have and the goals they want to achieve. So that is that they are not making mistakes in picking the best solution. It's there's then all sorts of ways in which we pull back from rationality. That becomes another modification of the rules of the game, that people are, they don't have perfect information, they have imperfect information, but with the imperfect information, they still make the best possible choice. Well, that's a kind of modified rationality, but it doesn't seem to become fully irrational, that is, making choices that are not the best choice they can make given the information that they have. Rationality in this context is meant to be a statement about individual cognitive processing of information and alternatives. Ideologies will figure into this, especially with respect to how your preferences get organized and what your beliefs are about the effects of your collective action. So what do you want and what are its consequences? That's where ideology shapes your beliefs about these processes. Ideology can interfere with rationality, you know, in various ways. Those are themes we'll be talking about more later on. Game theory itself doesn't really tell you why people hold the ideologies they hold. But it does tell you, given the ideologies they hold, what are its consequences for collective action? Okay, so the point here, just to get this first step wrapped up, is that one way you can get collective action is by having various kinds of meta-strategies, even with rational and selfish actors. This is sometimes referred to as, you know, in the collective action literature, one aspect of this are what are called selective incentives. You know, when the labor union sends out a goon squad to beat you up if you crossed a picket line, that is a strategy, given that the game is not a one-shot game. It occurs over time, right? And it says to a worker, now in deciding whether to cross the picket line, I have to worry about another consequence. That is, it will be a cost to me in the future for my non-cooperation. So non-cooperation will lead to a retaliation. That's tit for tat, so to speak. And that changes your preference ordering. Now suddenly cooperation becomes your first preference, not because of love for your comrades, not because of Kantian duty, but because the costs of non-cooperation have changed because of the physical threat from the union. That's still collective action with rational, selfish actors. Now, what Elster argues, and I think he's basically right, is that if you really have rational and selfish actors, and the only reason they're participating is this iterated process, that there are punishments for not cooperating and this iterated process of the game going on over time, that's a relatively fragile basis for robust collective action. Because everybody would still prefer to defect, it's just that it becomes costly to defect. And so if the cost conditions shift a little bit, then defections can occur. A collective action that's motivated primarily on that basis is easier to repress. You know, that is, police action against a collective action in which the only motivations are selfish and rational, and people are just calculating the personal costs and benefits, and it's iterated over time. Well, a small amount of repression suddenly raises the costs of cooperation, that is, of participation. So robust, durable participation in collective action usually means something other than rational, selfish actors. And that takes us to the second type, the second situation. Collective action with rational, non-selfish actors. And this is what is called, what Elster calls, conditional altruism, and what in the game theory literature is called an assurance game. An assurance game. So the premise of the free rider problem, if you remember, the premise of that was that the preference ordering of people in that matrix that we just looked at was BADC. But there's no reason to assume that actually that is the preference ordering of people. A different kind of preference ordering would be one in which people say really what they want most, their highest preference, is that everybody cooperate, including themselves. They can want to have everybody cooperate either out of love, I want everybody to cooperate because I care about everybody and everybody cares about everybody else, or duty. I feel that everybody ought to cooperate because everybody will benefit from this, whether they like each other or not. You know, so you can either have the moral Kantian mechanism. If you're attracted to the kind of Kantian way of thinking about this, one way that game theorists build this into their models is to talk about guilt fines. You know, if you feel a duty to cooperate and you don't, then you pay a cost, a psychic cost of guilt. I personally don't like the guilt fine way of talking about this. I think it actually doesn't capture the moral intuition about how duty works. It's true that there is a guilt fine. You do feel guilty, but I don't think that's the basic operation of a sense of obligation and responsibility. We don't have to get into that issue here. The key thing is that your preference ordering is different. Your first preference, your highest preference is A, no longer B. You'd rather have everybody cooperate, and you, including you. That's your first preference. Your second preference in conditional altruism is that you want everybody else to cooperate but not yourself, because you do want this collective action to succeed. And the only way it will succeed is if everybody else cooperates. So even though, you know, you would be failing in your duty, you'd still rather have a world, your second preference would be B. Your third preference is D, because you don't want to be a martyr. You know, you don't want to pay the sucker penalty. If nobody else is cooperating, well, then the Kantian obligation doesn't kick in. If nobody else is going to cooperate, then you don't cooperate. So the preference ordering is A, B, D, C, rather than B, A, D, C. Now, this change in preference ordering has some very big implications. Because now there's a really important condition for your participation, which is no longer just your preferences. You want to cooperate. That's your highest order preference. But you don't want to be a sucker, which means you have to have pretty good information about how other people are going to behave. You cooperate conditional upon everybody else cooperating. You don't want to unilaterally cooperate if nobody else is. An unconditional altruist is a person whose first preference is A and second preference is C. That is, they want to cooperate, they're going to do the right thing regardless of what anybody else does. And there are unconditional altruists. You know, a lot of martyrs in history are the unconditional altruists. They will stand by what they think are the moral actions, which is cooperation with the collective good, regardless of what anybody else does. So they are unilateral cooperators. When I use the word cooperation here, I'm using that term because we're talking about collective action. But you can really think of this as do it, if you're in the Kantian mode, what's the duty? You're thinking about what's the moral thing to do. So the unilateral cooperator would want everybody to cooperate. The martyr feels everybody should do what I'm doing, but I'm going to do it regardless. I'm an unconditional altruist. The term, again, I'm segueing back and forth between these two ideas. The notion of altruism is the love dimension. Altruism means you genuinely care about the well-being of others. The obligation and duty, sort of the unconditional, what would be the duty hold, the duty fulfiller, you know, moral agent, I guess. So altruism and duty are not the same idea. Duty means this is what you ought to do, whether or not you care about other people. It's what you ought to do. The altruist is somebody who cares about other people and wants to make and is willing to make sacrifices for other people's well-being. I think both go together. I mean, I'm not saying these are at war with each other. Duty and altruism are both in play in solidarity. And that's, solidarity is most robust when the moral sense of community reinforces the sense of comradeship, which is this sense of care for the other people. Yeah?
I have an idea. I mean, we can experience these choices in collective action in class. You know, there was this game around four teams, and they select the cooperative strategy or defective strategy. And if everyone cooperates, everyone gains points. I mean, gain points. If everyone defects, everyone loses points. But if some cooperate, some defect, the defective teams gain in kind of because of others. So those who cooperate, they lose, and those who defect, they win. So this is kind of modeling of real cooperation in life.
Right. Well, there are lots of games that have been introduced to test and to illustrate these principles and then to do what's called experimental game theory, which is which has some really fantastically interesting aspects to it. I can describe some of the most intriguing of these experiments later that illustrate the way in which this actually works, including some very recent stuff in what's called neuroeconomics. It's basically about the brain functions that are involved in different games, which, you know, it's pretty esoteric stuff, but it's pretty interesting. If we have time in the discussion, I can talk a little bit about this. But here I just want to, get the logic of the theoretical logic really clear. So here's the key thing that happens with conditional altruism. The condition in conditional altruism is information about how other people are going to behave. That is, you want to cooperate so long as you're confident that other people are going to cooperate. That's why it's called an assurance game. You need the assurance of the behavior of others. Now, the reason why this becomes really interesting is that it suggests that one of the things to understand about different contexts of struggle is how good is the information that people have about the likely behavior of other people. One of the problems with communities that are divided by ethnicity and race and other social divisions is that people don't have much confidence in the behavior of others. You know, a common term for that is trust. It doesn't necessarily mean you fear other people, but you just don't really know them well enough. You don't have a good sense of how they will behave. And the sense of information is, how do they behave when the police come out? It's not just, are they going to show up for the protest, but are they going to be steadfast? You need information of a pretty high quality to know how people will act in the stressful contexts of collective action. And that's not easy information to get. You know, you can't read it on a person's face. You can't even necessarily read it on their statements. If they say, yes, I'll stay there, well, maybe yes, maybe no. When push comes to shove, some people won't. It matters hugely for the success of many kinds of collective struggles when there is going to be confrontation, whether everybody remains steadfast or whether people flee with the first moves of the police, for example. So conditional altruism becomes a crucial form of collective action in which information and confidence and trust in the other participators becomes a crucial ingredient. And that then becomes something you can study. And now you can explain why sometimes collective actions are robust and other times they're fragile, because in some situations the underlying levels of trust and confidence is high, and in other situations, low. Elster regards conditional altruism as the essential content of class solidarity. He thinks, and I think this seems to me reasonable, that that's the real core of the idea. Solidarity means situations where people's preferences have changed to preferring cooperation over personal defection. Those preferences have changed for a combination of love and duty, you know, these two different dimensions of why you really prefer cooperation. Love and duty. But it's vulnerable to information failures. You know, it's vulnerable to the lack of sufficient, robust confidence in how other people will behave. Finally, there's collective action with irrational agents. Now, I think irrationality probably plays a certain amount of role in lots of collective struggles. You know, wishful thinking does play a role. People have exaggerated views of the importance of their own participation. In voting is a collective action problem, right? So you have an election, you really do care whether Obama or Romney gets elected. You think it does matter. So you're not indifferent. If you're indifferent, then there's no reason to vote. If you really think it doesn't matter, if you don't care, then you don't have any interests in play in voting. But you have Obama versus Romney. You really think it will be a disaster if Romney wins. But you know, if you think about it, that whether or not your vote isn't going to decide whether Romney or Obama wins. In fact, the probability that one vote is going to decide a national election is not just close to zero, it's vanishingly close to zero. Right? So why bother? It takes effort. You know, you have to wait in line, you have to organize your day. It takes a little bit of effort anyway to vote. Why vote? Well, one reason to vote is the duty reason. I'm a citizen. If I don't vote, I'm a free rider because I care on the about the outcome. And that's immoral. It's just wrong for me to care about the outcome, which will only take place if my fellow citizens vote for who I care for. And then I have a duty as a citizen to vote. I think that's, in fact, a very powerful part of why people vote. They vote out of a sense of this is the responsible thing to do. But I think there's also a little bit of magical thinking, and there's research to indicate this. People have this feeling, well, if I vote, then people like me are more likely to vote. Or if I don't vote, then people who share my views aren't going to vote. Or, well, maybe my vote will make a difference. And a lot of propaganda around voting is every vote counts. Well, it's not true that every vote counts. It's just bullshit. I mean, it just isn't true. It's not true that every vote counts. All votes count, but not every vote counts. You know, these are invocations of irrationality, which adds to the a little bit to the willingness of people to vote. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had a discussion, again, in my undergraduate class when I feel some ambivalence about telling people, you know, your vote's irrelevant, but you absolutely have an obligation to vote, you know. But where people say, no, my vote counts. And I say it counts symbolically. It counts as a expression of your commitment to a certain kind of world where politicians are held accountable. It counts for those reasons, but it doesn't count in the sense that it matters for the election. Well, I don't want to keep harping on that point because I don't want to, in fact, undercut people's desire to vote, of course. But so I do think irrationality does fit into it. And by irrationality here, I don't mean the emotional passion that comes from a feeling of connection to the process of collective action. That's part of the love and duty complex. You know, feeling that this collective action matters and that being part of it matters because that's the kind of person I am. That's not irrational. The irrationality is thinking that my own participation is pivotal to this when, in fact, it's not. And indeed, part of its moral importance comes from the fact that your individual participation is not what's going to make the difference. That is, it's the non-instrumental aspect of your individual participation. Yeah?
Can I ask a kind of personal question?
Sure.
Do you vote?
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. No, I vote because I believe whatever the flaws and however corrupt I feel the system is, I feel that voting is a necessary component of any democratic system, including the democratic world I would like, and that it's one of the few ways that we as a collectivity of citizens can impose mild constraints on powerful actors, you know, so et cetera. You know, so sometimes I have to hold my nose. And I also, this is a little bit different issue, I also don't engage with a few exceptions in protest votes. That is, so for example, in 2000, I didn't vote for Gore. For Nader. Much as I preferred Nader to Gore, I mean, unequivocally. There's no question that would have been if I could have snapped my fingers and had him elected, I would have. But I felt that in the actual empirical context, I did not want all people who shared my values to vote for Nader, because then Gore for sure would lose. Because it was not the case that enough people shared my values to get Nader elected. And that defeating Gore by having enough votes for Nader would not trigger a progressive process that would increase the probability of progressive politics down the road. Now, that would have, if I had believed that, if I had believed that it was worth defeating Gore by having a bigger vote for the Green Party, you know, being a spoiler, that it was worth it, even though the short term would have been worse, because in the long term it would have strengthened the Green Party, then I would have. You know, if I believed in that theory of what the subsequent unfolding of events would be likely, but I felt that in the American context, given the electoral rules of the game, it was completely implausible that the defeat of Gore by virtue of votes for Nader would have a progressive outcome, even in the longer term. Now, I could be wrong about that calculation. That's a very theoretical issue. You know, I have to invoke my theories about the likely trajectory into the future of present events. You know, it's, I think, an informed set of expectations, but by no means a certain one. Okay. I think we should take our break and reconvene at 15:15. I'll briefly talk about Roman numeral 4, the social conditions for solidarity, and then we can have a freewheeling discussion.